joining Lego was interesting because Lego is like the king of tangibility, right? Like they make pixels that people can put wherever they want, except those pixels are made out of plastic and I can touch them and I can hold them. And so the interesting thing about Lego, as I've always jokingly sort of said, it's like the world's oldest mixed reality company, right? They like, I have my reality, but then I also have, you know, a chunk of pixels that are on my desk.
World Beyond, a Mac One podcast, brought to you by Michael Mack and his Emotioneers of Tomorrow.
Hi everybody, Michael Mack here, the founder and CEO of Mac One. Welcome to the World Beyond. Our team at Mac One creates innovative theme park designs and media-based entertainment. We are the Emotioneers of Tomorrow. In this episode, my colleague Markus Ernst will explore what the future of tomorrow holds. Let's dive right in.
Thank you, Michael, and welcome back live out of Studio 78, right? Here in the heart of Germany's largest theme park, the Europa Park. My name is Markus, and here with me today is Brian Schwab. Brian is someone, who's been shaping the way games think for over two decades. He's a veteran game designer and one of the industry's leading experts in artificial intelligence for video games. He spent many years as a senior AI designer at Sony Online Entertainment, where he worked on iconic titles like EverQuest and helped pioneer intelligent, believable behaviors for NPCs, for non-player characters. And before, he has worked on legendary titles like Medal of Honor Underground or StarCraft II. So he is also an author of the book AI Game Engine Programming, which broke ground by translating complex AI concepts into, I would say, practical, efficient tools that developers could use to bring their game worlds to life. So AI doesn't just work, but feels real. This is what Brian is focusing on, and being responsive without burning through resources. But beyond his work in development, Brian has shared his insights at major industry events like GDC, the Game Developers Conference, where he continues to inspire a new generation of designers to think smarter about how games think. So me and we are all really, really happy to have you here on the podcast. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, it's a long trip of craziness, so I don't feel bad that like things are all over.
We're so happy to have you here on the podcast. And to give our listeners an idea of who is the person, Brian Schwab, we start every episode with our what we call the four quick fire questions. So it's a quick question and a quick answer. Are you ready for that?
Totally, go.
Cool.
One.
What's the dumbest way you've seen AI used lately?
I mean, the fact that we're in 2025 and I can still open a game on a PlayStation 5 with all the horsepower in the world and watch an AI pedal into a wall is atrocious, right? I love Baldur's Gate 3 to death. I have thousands of hours on it, and I still occasionally catch people stuck in a tree somewhere. You know what I mean? just mindlessly pedaling.
Right.
Two.
Brian, if you weren't busy revolutionizing interactive experiences, what boring desk job would you secretly want to do?
Boring desk job. Boring desk job. Man, I would want to be Bill Gates' personal assistant.
All right. Although these are the four quickfire questions, please tell me more about that. Why would you be especially Bill Gates' assistant?
Well, I think Bill Gates is one of the sort of super rich guys that like actually is trying to give back. And like a lot of the stuff that the Gates Foundation is doing is actually pretty interesting. And so I would love to be a boring cog in a large machine that's actually trying to give back.
And to quote Bill Gates, I think he just said these days that he wants to accelerate in giving his money as long as he's living, right? So helping him to spend a lot of money.
Exactly. I think we could even make, intelligent programs that would actually help him distribute that cash faster and more effectively.
That's great.
Three.
So what old piece of tech do you still love, even though it's totally outdated now?
Oh, I mean, I have a giant pile. I still will occasionally pull out my very first computer I ever owned in the late 70s is a Mattel Aquarius. You've never heard of it because I think they only sold about 5,000.
Five units?
Yeah. I may own three of them, right? It's a tiny little computer with a chiclet keyboard. It's got 2K of memory in it. However, it hilariously, not to bring up Bill Gates again, but it has Microsoft Basic on it, which is hilarious. And so it was the very first computer I ever bought. I think it took me 2 days to write a program that ran out of memory, you know what I mean, as a small child. And so, yeah, it's something that I like, love, and I pull it out occasionally. I still have a television that I can attach it to. Right. and it's a piece of junk. It's a worse computer than I think I currently have in you know, the Pomodoro timer on my desk right now.
What a great anecdote.
Four.
So let's forget the big hype for a second. So what small, like, everyday problem do you wish AI could just magically fix for you?
I think the biggest first one would be sort of like, I would love an intelligent, you know, thing for Outlook that I could say, hey, I'm looking for emails from these people. They need to have these keywords. And I'm looking for this for the next week. Because, like, I barely even use email anymore. It's gotten to the point where, like, you get 200 garbage emails. There's two good ones hidden in there somewhere. Some of them, sometimes they go to spam and sometimes they don't. Using email has become unusable. You know what I mean? Having a little intelligent system that I could quickly say, I need you to check for this, I need you to check for that, I need you to do this other thing, it would actually make email useful again. And it's kind of ridiculous that we don't actually have that, because I think that should be somewhat easy to make at this point.
Right. You know what they should do? What's the English name of this little assistant that Microsoft had for decades in like Microsoft Word?
Oh God, Clippy. What?
Clippy. I think they should totally bring back Clippy.
My guess is that they've probably done that a few times. Yeah. And like every time they do it, they're like, are we doing something stupid?
Great. Thanks, Brian. All right. Yeah. So let's dive a little deeper. I mentioned it briefly in the introduction. So you have all the honors. You've worked on big games like, again, Medal of Honor, Underground. You've worked on StarCraft 2, and you worked on so many great titles. But then you worked a lot with XR, Extended Reality, when you joined Magic Leap. And now you're at Lego. So looking back, which of these very different jobs challenged you the most, creatively and technically, and why?
So I sort of left the game industry. My last game was actually Hearthstone for Blizzard, right? So like after I helped them ship StarCraft 2, I then actually was the AI and gameplay guy for Hearthstone, the card game that's still out. And after I shipped that, I sort of realized that like it didn't really feel like a big win. In fact, somebody was like, are you excited? And I was like, yeah. And they were like, well, you don't seem excited. And I was like, well, that was my 19th game that I shipped.
Wow.
And they were like, you know, this was probably somebody at Blizzard that was maybe 25 years old or something. And so they were like, oh, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so, but then I thought about it when I went home that night and I was like, you know, I should be excited. That was a huge accomplishment. And I realized that I had gotten a little safe. So moving to Magic Leap was sort of my attempt to get out of my comfort zone.
Out of the comfort
zone. And to try to learn new stuff. And that was a pretty amazing jump, because like suddenly we weren't in just one industry, you know, like the craziness of Magic Leap was that it was more like 16 industries that were sort of welded together.
Different industries. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I would be sitting in a table and like the guy next to me was like one of the world's experts on like laser optic waveguides, and the next one over would be around CV, you know, computer vision. And then just everybody around the table would be a different industry. Totally. We would be having a conversation at the water fountain about like, oh, we're having this problem where we can't identify this. And somebody would be sitting there listening and they'd be like, well, you know, if we coat the optics, we can solve the problem that way. And we were just like, you know, suddenly all of the software people and all of the design people and all of the mechanical didn't mean anything. This guy solved it by putting a special coating on the yeah. one optic block, right? Yeah. Stuff you would never think of. And so that was a huge sort of like push from a challenge, because you then not only had to like make stuff that like people wanted, but you had to like integrate these dozen people that barely spoke the same language, even though we were all some flavor of designer engineer. Mm-hmm. There was a monstrous amount of sort of like new language to incorporate and different ways of integrating all of those people. So that was actually pretty challenging. Lego is challenging, but it's challenging in a different way. Now it's sort of like a multinational corporation, and mm-hmm. I'm dealing with a lot of like Danes and all kinds of people all over the world that may or may not speak native American English, yeah. you know what I mean? Yeah. Like yeah. nobody yeah. speaks Native American English, right? yeah. So it's a different challenge, but I would say that Magic Leap was probably the nastier one, because like it was just sort of like this hodgepodge of different industries mm-hmm. together.
And you were creating technology-wise something entirely new, something which was just not there before. And this particularly, you in your history, in your career, man, you've seen a lot. You've seen a lot of tech change in your career. So what was the name again of the first computer you had? What's the name again?
The Mattel Aquarius.
From the Aquarius, right? Mm. To the PS1. Mm. And now, then the Magic Leap 1. And now Apple Vision Pro, the X-ray glasses, all the upcoming devices, today's AI and XR. What's one... Yeah, main rule for having experience like that has always stayed the same, no matter how much the tech changed.
I mean, the big trick with making good experiences on anything is always to sort of like know your customer, know the audience really, really well, so that you can sort of start from where they currently are, right? Like, it doesn't really matter what kind of crazy ass tech you put on somebody. Yeah. If you know where they're starting from, you can sort of start there and then lead mm-hmm. them in the direction you want to take them. If you don't know where they are at all, and you just sort of start throwing things at them, it may connect, it may not. But like, knowing your audience is actually like the only real silver bullet. You know what I mean? Like, everything else is like, you have to figure it out the hard way.
Yeah, I would fully agree, because I think going back in tech history, this is, in my opinion, one of the main reasons why Google Glass so very much failed, because they didn't pay close attention to where is the target audience and where's the point A where they are starting. And going back now a couple of years, when Meta launched the first Ray-Ban glasses, or in cooperation with Ray-Ban, I think this is the one thing that they truly solved. And this has been discussed outside of this podcast. This has been discussed before, but I think that's a very crucial point, that they figured out exactly who their target group is, and they immediately understood and developed a very well understanding of what the starting point, the point A of the audience is, and leading them from the point A, which is the point that they are aware of and that they know, to a point B, rather than bringing them to a point Z. Because this is too much for too many people. So bringing them from the point A where they are, and giving them something that they know, and leading them to this something that they do not yet know. So what people do know is what a wayfarer is. What is a pair of sunglasses? Yeah. Everyone knows what a pair Everybody of sunglasses knows. Is. But what people do not know, or did not yet know, is, okay, what does it mean to have a wearable computer on your face? And this is, I think, the smartest point that Meta did here.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I always jokingly, I have this like... corollary. So, you know, the famous quote is, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, right? Mm-hmm. Arthur C. Mm-hmm. Clarke, mm-hmm. I believe.
Yeah.
My sort of secondary take on that is like, that implies a sort of like a particular mindset that I would call mm-hmm. kind of like the hopeful mindset, right? The more cynical mindset is any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from bullshit. Right? Because like, basically what we're saying is like, if I'm here, and any sufficiently advanced means farther than I'm sort of comfortable with.
Comfortable.
Right? Yeah. And mm-hmm. and in my years, what I have found is that people are usually comfortable with about a 15% jump from mm-hmm. wherever they currently mm-hmm. are. It's not very far, actually. Definitely there's people out there that love just flying without knowing anything. But most people want about a 15% step. Mm-hmm. in some direction. If they do that, they'll say, hey, this is great. This is so much better than the old way, blah, 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 blah. If you go farther than that, then the hopeful people think that it's magic, and they'll either like adopt it or not based on whether they think that's cool to walk around with something magical.
Yeah.
Or the cynic people will like watch the marketing and they'll watch the whatever and they'll be like, that's crap. That's not real. That's vaporware. That's trying to grab VC funding. That's whatever it is. And they'll usually just not believe it because it's too far beyond. And so a lot of what we had to do with Magic Leap was to try to like find those far out kind of like use cases, those sort of native spatial use cases. But then we had to drag it all the way back and say like, okay, now given the fact that nobody has any goddamn idea what we're talking about,
exactly,
how do we make steps from here to there so that people don't just think we're full of crap or that we're just magical and that they don't understand it at all?
Yeah, this makes a lot of sense. Absolutely. So Brian, I wanted to briefly talk with you about the role of AI nowadays and I think you wrote this book, AI Game Engine Programming, right?
Long time ago.
So this shows that you have a deep understanding of making the brains for games. So today I have the opinion or the impression that everyone is talking about AI in terms of generative AI. So AI equals creating content. I'm a bit puzzled. What's your opinion? Are we actually too much focused on this generative AI part rather, or do we tend to forget how to make AI that actually acts smart? Mm. Not generating smart things, but actually acting smart.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is that, like, I don't know how much you know about the history of, like, ChatGPT. It was originally designed as sort of like a way of getting good, cheap translation between English and Mandarin Chinese, right? Like that was the two big needs. And the requirements for good translation between those languages, because they're so different, basically led to them developing the large language model, right? Which is sort of like, there's enough probabilistic notion there of like how to translate that you, for all intents and purposes, built up a probabilistic model of like language itself. Right.
Yeah.
And given that, they're then able to sort of like ask it questions and have it generate the answers somewhat probabilistically. So the reason it's originally called generative is because it was allowing them to sort of generate query sequences based on this large language model. And since they've gone there, what they've done is said, okay, well, what if we start to talk about, you know, sequences of other things or sequences of even sequences of actions that lead us in a place like the large language model first had a particular task that it was after, but then what it really did was just allowed us to have almost like a natural language way of communicating with computers in general. And so you have a long litany of AI tasks that are either planning algorithms or other sort of more cognitive things than just generative. But a lot of like what you're seeing as sort of like the focus is more just because this natural language kind of interface, as well as like the visual generation, right? Because the same sort of language model that allows me to translate between languages allowed me to take a bunch of pictures off the internet and sort of make a probabilistic picture generator in the same way that we had a probabilistic text generator. This natural language interface to the computing and this way of sort of generating pictures using the same sort of model as the language model is just novel enough that's why everybody's focused on it. But in the background, what we're starting to do is sort of take all of the 50 plus years of like really good AI knowledge and starting to like now being able to attach it to a natural human interface and a way of outputting things that people can understand. And we can start to get to the beef of real good AI. It's just that for right now, I think a lot of the reason why you're seeing so much focus on it is because it is very novel and it's such a real-time process that people can sit and play with it. And anytime somebody can sit and play with it, they tend to do so and they tend to think on it a lot and they tend to like talk on the internet to everybody else about all the stuff that they've made. It's a fascinating new toy, right? And so it ends up being in the news.
So now I want to dig a little deeper on this very topic, because this is something that us in the theme park industry, we're constantly thinking about this term of creating, I almost don't even want to use this word, immersive experiences, because it has been used so often. But let's maybe go back a step and let's talk about interactive experiences and about interactivity. And I know people, including us from the theme park industry and from the themed entertainment industry, of course, we're using the word interactivity a lot. But from your perspective and with your expertise, I mean, you've done this for decades. So what does interactivity that really means something mean to you today, especially with AI involved? And honestly, where do most experiences still really mess up?
It's interesting. For me, interactivity is a very sort of specific thing. I think people get bogged down in like, you know, do you mean a game? Do you mean anything that you can interact with? You know what I mean? Is a light switch interactive? That kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I personally believe that it is sort of like technically a lot of things are interactive. But the sort of like stock answer for that is there some way for me to provide inputs and I get back a set of outputs very, very quickly, usually in a loop? I would call that a feedback loop. And I would say that for me, interactivity is the ability for me to be in feedback loops with a particular computer, right?
Yeah.
And so if I sit down with my phone and I'm swishing around and it's doing stuff because of that, that's an interactive system. If I'm sitting with a joystick and I'm providing some input and things on the screen are giving me input back or feedback back, that's an interactive system. I tend to sort of say, like, if I'm reading a book, that's just content that's coming at me. It's sort of like a story. Whereas if I'm using a joystick and doing stuff and having things on the screen move around, that's kind of like, it goes beyond a story. And now it's sort of a conversation, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not just consuming content.
That makes sense.
I'm saying something and you're saying something back, and I'm saying something and you're saying something back. And so that the difference between a conversation and just a story is the difference between content and kind of like interactive content.
Right. I agree. Do you see a different quality in distributing or delivering experiences that are linear in a way, like telling a good story, like in a movie or in a book, by reading a book? Or is there a different quality of experiences when you are creating interactive experiences?
I mean, I think it kind of depends on the quality of the interactive experience. I think it's a lot more difficult to make the level of kind of content be as high quality with an interactive experience than it is with a movie, because I can control the camera, I can control the actors, I can have specific background soundtrack music written by John Williams that makes everybody cry and the whole nine yards, right? Like, everything can be perfect.
That's true.
And you have to allow for a lot more personal expression in a game. You have to allow for very erratic user behavior in a game. Yeah. You have to have an enormous amount of sort of potential possibility space in a game. And yet at the same time, still potentially tell a cohesive story with all of that craziness. And so I think the part of the reason why it feels a lot more higher quality in some cases in a book is simply because it's so difficult to make really good interactive stuff that, like, we haven't seen a ton of it. One of the things that is actually going to become, I think, more prevalent because of generative systems is higher quality interactive stuff, because the story can kind of make up for all the craziness that you're up to. Or if I make radically different choices, suddenly the story can kind of help. You know, I was actually in a very small startup between Magic Leap and the game industry called Storybricks, believe it or not. Hilariously, now that I work at Lego. And Storybricks was literally about us. When you mentioned that I worked on EverQuest, actually, that startup, what we had done is gotten a contract with EverQuest 2 to do their quest system there, which we were under the hood of that giant thing, trying to make procedural quest stuff. It was like the start of ChatGPT, except before ChatGPT. We were basically generating quests based on what was going on and who you were and what you were doing and who you were talking to and what you were up to and what was going on in that town right now. We would procedurally generate you some quests in game. So we were teaching the whole design troupe to like write all of their lore in this abstract language effectively to so that like we had generative systems that could then make use of that and could do all of that. But back in 2015, it required, you know, a group of five hardcore PhD AI clowns to do this specifically just for, you know, quests in a dumb game. Whereas now, you know, we have a base system so that we can do all this kind of craziness all over the place.
This story breaks story. That's so cool. And this brings me to your current position at LEGO now. So you're working on how physical, using the bricks, the LEGO bricks, the physical and the digital play, how they fit together. And many people worry nowadays that kids spend maybe too much time online, consuming digital content. So I think this brings you in a very unique position at LEGO, at this intersection. So how do you make sure that tech like AI makes playing with real toys and being creative better, and not just replace it or make kids just watch and, as you mentioned, by reading a story, passively consume?
You know, the interesting thing at Magic Leap was that we had the ability to put pixels anywhere we wanted, right? I could be sitting mm-hmm. here with my glasses on and there could a Tyrannosaurus Rex could run across my desk and it could have a score and it could send me an email, you know, do all these things. But when you saw that happen, everybody would like kind of reach out and just their hand would just go right through it, right? Yeah. Because there's no tangibility, even though it's perfectly aligned to your world and it's like mm-hmm. taking into account all the physical objects and it's lit the same way and all of that, it doesn't matter because it's like just photons, right? Mm-hmm. That lack of tangibility, what we found in Magic Leap was you had to do a lot of work to try to like make it not be quite so bad. So like one of the early things that we used to do literally would like, you could open your hand like this and a menu could appear right here on your palm. Because then when I went like this, I could feel the button because my finger touched my hand and I'd go beep. And so like, because if there's a button floating in the air right here, it doesn't matter how compelling that button is or how juicy the animation, there's no touch on my finger and therefore it's not as compelling. And so if I put it right on my palm, bang. Point being, tangibility was a problem. So joining LEGO was interesting because LEGO is like the king of tangibility, right? Like they make pixels that people can put wherever they want, except those pixels are made out of plastic and I can touch them and I can hold them. And so the interesting thing about LEGO, as I've always jokingly sort of said, it's like the world's oldest mixed reality company, right? They like, I have my reality, but then I also have, you know, a chunk of pixels that are on my desk. You know what I mean? And so for me, working at LEGO is interesting because suddenly if we can start to get a little bit of like that interactivity and that kind of like dynamic behavior, but we have all that tangibility, then one of the things that we researched while at Magic Leap was the fact that part of the reason that people were scrolling to such a degree, I mean, obviously like doom scrolling is been shown to be sort of psychologically compelling just all by itself. Like you're always trying to get to the bottom of the list because otherwise you think you might be missing some information. And if there's no bottom of the list, you're hosed, right? But the other thing that's interesting is like our eyes take in an enormous amount of data, but like our hands, like scrolling with your finger gives your hand basically no stimulation whatsoever. It's effectively like just drinking water all day. Mm-hmm. It's like a sterile sort of non-stimulant to your finger. And when you rob your hands of all stimulus and you rob, you know, like you might not even be listening to anything. You're just sitting there scrolling and it takes an enormous amount of time to consume all of the information that you need if it's just visual. And so part of the reason you're addicted to a screen is because you need two orders of magnitude more data if it's all visual as opposed to if it's tactile or other things. And so using your other senses, using your hands and your other things actually almost sort of naturally leads you to not need as much screen time because like that tangibility ends up providing your brain with the, you know, it's daily recommended amount of calories in each type of sense, right? So robbing yourself of all of that extra senses is part of the reason why people spend so much time scrolling, because like your eyes just need that much more data than any other senses. And so being at Lego has been really interesting, because what we find is if we get this dynamic behavior, but it's in a tangible sort of sense, yes, we can actually like give kids, give adults even, a lot of what they're looking for without a screen. Mm-hmm. We don't have to worry about it. And like, it's more that like the toys are providing some of the dynamic behavior and some of the other things that their older toys were missing.
Right. Oh man, I take a mental note on this that I absolutely do want to memorize this, because I think it's so very important what you're saying. And this reminds me to your amazing talk back at the Aureas in January this year, which for all the listeners out there, I would highly recommend to check this, Brian's talk at vjoy.de. So make sure to check this keynote from Brian. And I remember, Brian, you creating this picture of when most of us try to envision the future and envision spatial computing, which we're going to talk about in a second. We rather quickly came to this image of Minority Report with Tom Cruise waving his hands somewhere in the void, and it feels like the future, but actually it's not. It's not, and it's not a future that we want, because it is absolutely unnatural. Yeah. Because it lacks this tangibility. Exactly. That's exactly the point. And I think this is a very crucial information for me and it makes total sense that to create this stimulus in a sufficient way, you'd have to bring so much input because we lack tangibility. And I think this is really super important to think about how we want to interact with technology in the next iteration of hardware.
No, for sure. It's the amount of disconnect that we had gotten to, you know what I mean? Like I used to say a lot at Magic Leap that like we call it personal computing, but it's actually more portable computing. Like there's not a lot of personality there with an iPhone, right? It's a beautifully portable device, but it's not very human. It's very, very abstracted away
Fair
from
point.
The human.
Yeah.
I think my metaphor I used to use all the time was like, if I have a device that I can carry around that like heats up the room, right? That's called a space heater, right? It's like this like little square thing, and it sits in a cone of heat comes at me. And yes, it's beautifully portable and it does all these things. But if a portable heater is very, very human centric, then it's called a coat. Right? Like it's not a stupid little device that I have to carry around and I have to point it at me and it only comes out in this and I have to kind of stand in front of it like this. Like suddenly getting the heat is like me coming to the heater, whereas like a coat is like, okay, I've got the coat on and now I can do anything that a human being can do and stay warm. That's kind of the difference, right? Between like a portable computer that's like this little screen that I'm sort of and like the wearable was sort of more like me. It was like, it was coming to me as opposed to me coming to it, right? And like the thing with the future is it's more about reclaiming our humanity. Like we finally have enough computing power and enough smarts that like we can actually like, we don't have to abstract away the human to this tiny little swipey screen. We can sort of like go, look, no. The human is now not required to do anything. I, as a tech chunk, is going to come to you and I'm going to meet you where you are. And I'm going to interact with the table and the chair and you and the person next to you. The amount of information that we had to take in when we would make real spatial applications. So like, even if something was laid out as in a semi-screen manner and I was interacting with five other things on my desk, if I stood up and walked away I wanted the stuff to come with me, it would change shape so that it was best laid out so that like while I was walking, it was maybe off to the side and a little muted so that I would like not trip on anything. And if somebody came up and started talking to me, it would move the hell out of the way so that I could see the person. Mm-hmm. And it would maybe even pause if something was running so that like I could actually hear what they were saying. Like suddenly the software had to have social graces and it had to know so much more context about me as a person. And to me, that's the big secret of the far future of computing is like reclaiming all of our humanity so that like it's not so much about like my tech always getting in the way, right?
Getting in the way. Yeah, that's true. And maybe a follow-up question, because I'm really interested in what's your take on this term of, again, of spatial computing. which to me, when I first put on an Apple Vision Pro, really only after trying it, I understood what fundamental change or what paradigm shift this could actually mean if we are consequently or really following this new type of how do we want to interact with digital content. So I understand, of course, and especially since the release of Apple Vision Pro, spatial computing has been the new kid in town, the new cool term. But for you, your opinion, I'm asking your opinion specifically. Is this just a new name for extended reality, AR, VR, MR, you name it? Or does it really mean a big change? So what do you think will spatial computing mean for regular people in the next 5 years?
So the first part of your question, is it a new term? I would say kind of, yeah. And I mean, even Magic Leap was using mixed reality until like Microsoft kind of decided to like start branding things with the word mixed reality. And as soon as that happened, then Magic Leap even sort of switched over to spatial computing. Mm-hmm. It's a term based on the fact that like we don't have a standard just yet. And we haven't gotten far enough out into the populace that like back in the early days of shooting movies, there was like six different types of camera. And so it'd be like shot in Panavision, shot in CinemaScope, shot in whatever. And it's like, does anybody give a rip about what it was shot in? You know what I mean? Like no, they just went to the movie theater and they saw the movie, right? It wasn't. That was like silly terms that people that were inventing stuff back in the 100 years ago were sort of like throwing about, right? And I think we're sort of in that same spot where like you hear, you know, AR, XR, MR, blah, blah, blah. And spatial computing. It's all just trying to like make sure that like you show up on the search engine and that your patent has a term on it that can be sort of differentiated. In reality, I think any of those terms are good as long as people kind of understand what they're talking about, which of course nobody does right now, right? It's mostly just understanding that like right now your portable computer, you know, it does know some things about the world. It knows kind of where it is because it just happens to have a GPS sensor in it. Yeah. And it may even have like, you know, depending on the phone, it might have like a microphone that's turned on all the time. And it might have even a camera that may be watching certain things. But for the most part, it's not very aware of its space and its time and its position, right? But the interesting thing is that when you actually mount a computer to a person,
right,
in order to function at all, you actually have to like know enough about that person that you can kind of like a computer vision person will tell you that in order to sort of like recognize my hand in front of the phone, right? So I have to take an image of my hand and I have to track the shape of my digits. But the other thing I have to do is like I have to have a sensor that's in the phone that knows that this is moving versus the fact that this is moving. So you have to know enough about the thing where the sensors are so that you can edit that motion out of the motion that's sensing here. So if I put that thing on my head, I now have to know enough about me that I can like stop affecting whatever it is that the computer is sensing outwardly based on what I'm doing.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Where I'm going with this is that like spatial computing, to me, I always sort of said that it should be more about like human-centric computing, some sort of like human computing, because what it's really doing, it's not so much about the fact that it's spatial or that it's, you know, got these particular sensors or that it like projects light in certain ways. What it's really actually doing is sort of like finally understanding enough about the human world and the human being that like it can serve up its feedback loops in the most human way possible. And so to me, like the term that we'll eventually get to, we'll just call it computing because we won't think of it in some wacky ass way. We'll just be like, yeah, I spoke to the computer and the computer gave me the information, or I tapped on my desk and it gave me my notifications. We won't think of it in spatial terms or this terms or that terms because like
you're right, it's just going to be
computing. It'll actually be so integrated into our world that we'll just think of it as computing.
Yeah, that's true. Would you say a workshop is human-centric?
A workshop?
Like you being like in a physical workshop? This was the paradigm shift in my head that I think that this is where we should be aiming, is that just like when I'm in a real workshop and I'm like working with different kinds of, I don't know, like tools, I go to this specific part of the room if I want to use the hammer. And I go to this specific area of the room if I want to use a different tool. And the same applies to me, or at least in my, how I envision this human-centric computing in the future, that I can execute digital tasks or interacting with digital content. And so I can execute computing tasks, but located in the room, similar to this physical workshop where I go to this corner and to that corner to execute, to do this and to this. I use different tools, maybe for this one task. Maybe still a classical keyboard with keys is the best way to interact or the best way to communicate with the computer. And maybe for the next task, using hand gestures or spoken language is the best way to interact with the machine. So this is my idea of how I envision how we should interact with computers in the future. So how does this resonate with your vision?
I mean, 100%. I mean, a lot of the experiments that we did at Magic Leap were around kind of like, how do we have complex interfaces in the real world right now? And to your point, you know, a garage workbench. Or my fully stocked kitchen, or even like the cockpit of a 747, they're all sort of like complex physical controls that have been given good affordances so that I can kind of feel my way around and get more information. They're usually within two arms reach, or there's like it's a wider station so that me and another person are doing work at the same time. And now there's sort of like 1.7 arms reach, right, around us in a bubble. Like to your point, like I tend to like have workstations so that like standing at that workstation changes the mode of operation right then. And there's a mixture of sort of like, you know, analog and sort of digital and flick switch controls so that like it makes sense that I'm turning this on and then I'm dialing something and I'm doing these other things. And so most of the work that we did at Magic Leap was around trying to find better interfaces that were digitally empowered, but that were very, very from reality. Because again, we were trying to say, this is where people are in reality right now. Let's start there and go forward. Like we even made a bunch of sort of like controls that were very, very based on reality-based stuff. So like having a file cabinet that you could pull the handle open, but then you could just sort of keep doing it forever. Right. So you could have a filing cabinet that was 3 miles long if you want.
Okay.
And you could just like kind of like tap on the side because it also had A through Z on the side. And you could just tap on the T and it would go zzz and like bang. And so like it was very easy to sort of say, what if we use the exact physical interface that people use, but we digitally enhanced it so that
digitally
it was
enhanced it. I see.
Sort of interesting. And likewise, we had other things. But like even to the point of like, like you say, if I go over here, I'm going to use this tool. If I go over here, I'm going to use this tool. One of the other things that was really interesting was zones on your desk so that when I put my coffee cup, when I put my coffee cup on the little ring on my desk that said email, it would bring up my email thing. And then I could literally turn my coffee cup and it would scroll through the list. You know what I mean? Like I didn't have to my coffee down barely. I just put it down and I could use it as the control and I could pick it up and put it over here and it would bring up my calendar and I'd just twist my cup and I would just hold on to it the whole time. Like this really interesting way of integrating with the way that you sort of just were doing things naturally. We went really deep and we found just an enormous amount of crazy goodness that we could find based on reality, based on respecting the way people wanted to do stuff. And what was really fun about that was very quickly you decided that like, if we don't make the button be the key, like the button is the gatekeeper in like, you know, iOS right now, if I pick up my phone, I literally either have to look at it in the right way so that my face will unlock it, or I have to like figure out how to get the dang menu to come up so I can hit the 9 buttons and get in.
Exactly.
Everything is a gatekeeper in a more sort of human-centric way. Like it's obviously looking at me and I'm heading over there already. By having it always be on me, it's always looking at my eyes. It knows I'm me. It doesn't. I don't need to have authorization all the time because it has my irises. You know what I mean? Like I can, like it can trust that it's still me because it can sense that it's still me. Yeah. And so the ability to sort of like use your tech in a more sort of like free and open manner is all by itself more human-centric, right? But like what we really realized once we started mimicking, like you say, like a workbench or other things, was that muscle memory came into effect just as much as sort of like remembering the menus. It's a very non-human abstract thing to go up to the file menu and then say, ah, they put print in the file menu and not in the blah, blah, blah menu. Mm-hmm. Whereas like if I have a printer sitting over there and I go walk over there and I stand there and it starts to like let me print stuff, like to your point, like you start to like use your mind to learn where the tools are. And so you just reach for the wrench because you always put the wrench in the same place. And we were able to sort of show very quickly that we could build interfaces that let that part of the regular human brain very much take over very easily. One thing that human beings have is proprioception. Like I know where my hands are in 3D space without looking at them all the time. It's like one of our greatest, most high fidelity senses. And so like if you have some good haptic feedback or you're putting things on tables and stuff, you can very quickly, especially if you use tangible totems as being things that you use, like I say, like coffee cups and other things, suddenly I can reach over, grab the coffee cup without even looking, and then use it and da 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 and put it over there and keep going in exactly the way that a good mechanic has got his face buried in whatever, and they're just sort of grabbing tools and kind of doing stuff, and they never really move their head. That actually led to a bunch of really awesome applications, even in the medical world, where like we have hardcore, you know, surgeons who are currently using the Magic Leap 2 device because they can get a bunch more information and not have to move their head away from staring at the little blood vessel that they can't let go, you know? And so it's been pretty amazing to sort of see that, like, you're right on, like mimicking the way that we do things without any technology is usually the better way.
Right, right. Absolutely. And I still remember, I think it was also part of your talk, and really this information, this stuck with me ever since. It's this incredible capability of our brain is that, maybe a little bit hard for me to explain it in English, but I try, is that by the experiences that we've made in our life, without touching physically, without physically touching a surface, we can already assume how the surface will feel like just by looking at it. So if I look at a glass surface, I can envision how this might feel. And if I see a wooden surface, I can assume how this might feel. And this goes even further. This is not even a tactile capability that we have, but we could also estimate how it would feel if we would be touching it with our tongue, how it would taste. And this is super crazy if you think about that. So if I see a concrete wall, I could, based on my memory, already assume how it would taste. This is a capability of our brains that is so powerful that I think our nowadays user interfaces lack this kind of, or do not pay tribute to this capability of our brains.
It's interesting too, because it works both. It's like memory in general, right? Like we store all of our sensory data together as a memory, right? So like, that's why they say, like, if you're sad, if you try to remember happy memories, you might smile, but also if you just smile, it might drag up happy memories. Like it sort of works both directions. Yep. So where I'm going with this is, we actually had a couple of really early demos on Magic Leap where we had this little flying thing that would go around the room with you. And it had these little exhaust vents on the back that were really, really well modeled. And they had like heat coming out the back, and they were kind of brightish red. And like you would put your finger up and it would come buzz around kind of like a dragonfly. And I kid you not, at least 40 to 70% of people that like played with that reported that their finger felt warm. Like that when that thing got close, they would be like, how are you doing the thing with the finger? And we were like, what are you talking about? There was so many reality cues that their brain was dragging up, like, well, everything is laid out exactly what it should be. So my finger should feel hot right now. So my finger actually starts. And a lot of people would say, yeah, my finger felt hot. because everything else was so lined up well. Like, it was exactly right. The heat distortion was there. We were even putting a little bit of red light on your finger, like when it got up close. You know what I mean? And so, like, everything was telling you that there was a hot object right next to your finger. And so, like, a lot of people would feel the heat. And, like, that happens. Like, it was crazy how much that happened. Like where we would find these phenomenon when, if you trigger enough reality cues in the human mind, the Photoshop ability of our brain mashes the rest of those reality cues in to try to make sense of what it's seeing. And like, I think you're going to see a heck of a lot more of that as we go forward.
Totally.
I mean, VR is doing some of this, right? Because it's like such a ability to pull us in and have so much feel kind of real. Like I could feel I'm very high up, but like we're just missing some key details. And so like as we get more and more of actual reality, and we can keep a lot of reality cues, but boy, it becomes so much better and so much more magical.
Yeah, that's true. So as you might probably hear in the background, this very studio I'm in is located in the literally in the heart of Europa Park. So of a very physical, highly themed leisure park or theme park. So to quote you, I can't remember where I found this quote, but I think you once said that your mission is to find fun, interactive experiences and share them. So speaking of theme parks, but maybe other places, where are these maybe unusual places or fields where you get inspiration from for new fun and interactive ideas? So where do you get your inspiration from?
I was lucky with Magic Leap in that I got 6 full years with a team of 30 people and, you know, the interaction lab, and we mm-hmm. did an enormous amount of exploration. So I got lucky and then I was able to just sort of like try a billion things. But to be honest, like we worked with a ton of partners. You know, I worked with Disney on mm-hmm. what became some of the Star Wars stuff. I worked mm-hmm. with Universal Studios on what became Mario Land. Yep. You know what I mean? Like I got to work with some of the theme parks as well, because they were doing this digital physical mixturing together as well. And so like, to me, the interesting thing, like, where do I find the inspiration? Believe it or not, for me, the inspiration is just about, like, in general, when I find myself playing. You know, I think this is maybe why I joined Lego, because I've always been that kind of guy. I'm always picking stuff up and I'm always mm-hmm. playing with it. And I'm always like, what if you could do this? And what if you could do that? Mm-hmm. And I'm always trying to start from that physical thing and then go from there. And, you know, even when I was making games, a lot of my games are more about like making the AI mess up in a human way. And that's how you feel like it's really a human that you're playing against. You know what I mean? Like if the AI just sort of stops and you go by, then you might think it's broken. Where if it trips, then you're like, you tripped. And so starting with reality and kind of like going from there has always been my thing. And so like, mm-hmm. I think my inspiration is to just sort of like stay kind of like awake and kind of like play a lot and kind of like always be looking for like, what if I could take this play and kind of like use it in a different way or in a more wide manner. I think one of the things I really like about theme parks is that they're sort of like fantasy made manifest, right? Like they're physical by their very nature.
Yeah.
And like, I think that like theme parks in general, and this is why I came and gave a talk with you guys, is because I feel like theme parks in general are sort of the last bastion of like, hey, technology can be very human centric and very hidden. Mm-hmm. And like the primary reason that we have it is not because we want to be interacting with technology. No. It's because we want the fantasy and the super Earth. You know what I mean? Like the fun version of Earth where we're not surrounded by craziness. and so I've always loved theme parks in that manner. And I think that there's so much that we can learn by just like watching people in our parks and like, where are the parts of our park where they're not having fun? How could we make that fun?
Sure.
Where are the parts of our park where a lot of people aren't having fun, except those two kids over there seem to be having a hell of a lot of fun. What are they doing that we could maybe try and emulate so that like the rest of the people in that area could have fun? And you know what I mean? Like I feel like there's a lot to be learned about like just sort of like exploring like the human sense of play in general, and figuring out how we sort of piggyback on that playful nature that we already have by forcing our technology to kind of like go there.
Yeah. What a perfect advertisement for going to theme parks. So everyone who's looking for a reason to come visit us here at Europa Park, just rewind the last minute and listen to Brian's statement here. So Brian, before we wrap up this episode, I'd like to ask you this famous final question that we ask all of our guests. So if you look 7 years into the future, what do you think the world of entertainment, specifically entertainment, will look like
7 years from now?
World of entertainment. So within 7 years, the first long range studies that show that like close displays don't harm kids' vision as they grow up will finally kind of come out. And because of that, you're going to start to see headsets that are finally starting to be okay to be worn by smaller children. Okay. And because of that, we're going to have a slew of sort of like spatial computing, if you want to call it that, you know, ubiquitous human-centric computing that can now be used with younger kids in school so that they have a much higher fidelity level of being able to be taught at a personal level. Yeah. I think that because of that, suddenly school is going to become more fun. It's going to become more like recreation, like entertainment. And so I feel like we're going to have a massive upsurge in like people's ability to interact with technology in that way. And so suddenly technology is going to be a huge part of recreation in general. And we're going to see a lot more sort of personalized goodness, a lot more sort of always on goodness, a lot more sort of like, you know, I'm sitting here in my room and who the heck knows who's going to come through the door and have an experience with me. And like, it might just be fun to just like, who knows what. It's going to become within 7 or so years, I think we're going to have another surge of crazy randomness. And I think that like, hopefully within that 7 year period, we actually have a, you know, another surge of sort of like usability, where we get past some of the novelty that we're seeing right now, where everything is sort of like, it's just about novelty. There's not really a lot of usefulness, and it's not really something that people see a lot of value in. The term AI slop gets handed around a lot. But like, imagine if all of that variability and all of that stuff was actually contextually rich, was actually meaningful to the individuals that it was coming at, and was actually responding to their intent in a more meaningful manner. Suddenly that becomes like a pretty intensively interesting place to be. And I think that within 7 years, we're going to be there where our recreation and our computing has finally figured us out to the point where we can actually derive meaning from it and we can actually derive fun from it.
Brilliant. Brian, those were fascinating insights, really. Thanks. Thanks a lot. Thank you so very much. And also to wrap this up, thanks to all of you, our dear listeners, for again tuning in. So make sure to hit the subscribe button and see you next time on The World Beyond. Thanks.
Mac One presents The World Beyond. Brought to you by Michael Mack and his Emotion Ears of Tomorrow.